listening to Ding Dong Darkness Time Season 2, Stephen King Boogaloo. I gathered several of my most well-read friends together to discuss many of our favorite works by the master of the macabre himself. If you like what you hear, tell the world. In the meantime, let's talk some scary stories. Oh, and beware the spoilers, folks. They're a doozy. Greetings yet again, ding-dongs and constant readers. I'm Allison Dixon, and I'm so glad you're here at the beginning of the end of Season 2. Over the previous 10 episodes of this exploration of the Godfather of Darkness, Stephen King, you met not only some of my favorite people, but hopefully you've gained some additional insights on some of his best works and have taken an opportunity to revisit some of them as well. Highlights for me include entering the confines of claustrophobic convalescence with Annie Wilkes and our friends from Press Play and Scream, grocery shopping amid the mist-draped cosmic horrors of Another Realm with Brett from The Prosecutors, walking the cells of Shawshank State Prison with Kate Jenkins, and poring over the bleakest depths of human grief in a forbidden burial ground with James D.F. Hanna. And really, that's just a small taste. There's a ton of good stuff to listen to, so I hope you go back and check it out. But now we've arrived at the season finale, and we're not going out quietly. In fact, we're cranking this thing up to a much higher gear, putting the pedal to the metal and possibly running down an obnoxious Bible salesman or two. Welcome to not only an exploration, but a downright celebration of the piece of work that made Stephen King a triple threat: writer, screenwriter, and feature film director. That's right, folks, we are talking Maximum Overdrive. And you already must know who's joining me for this one, because he's mentioned it on this season once or twice. And if there's anything I'm driven to do in this life, it's keeping King Ding Dong happy. So welcome back to the show, Chris.
King Ding Dong reporting. Very excited about this one. I really want to make the noise, the chun, 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 chun. Yeah. You can't do it any justice, but no. That to me is just like the best intro music I could ever have.
Real quick off the bat, do you happen to know if that bit of music was made by AC/DC as well? Because they did the soundtrack, but I don't know.
I wondered the same thing and could not find any tidbits on that noise. It's like, to me, it's more like, this is probably blasphemy, but it's more iconic than with Friday the 13th, right? To me, it's more like signature than even that telltale sign.
It's such an interesting music sound effect, but it also has a bit of like a cool bass undertone to it. It's just, it's a cool sound.
I really want it to be AC/DC who did it. I really, really do.
You know, if I find out, I'll put it out on the Twitters and let people know. But Maximum Overdrive is, you know, a lot of people, when they hear about this movie that are familiar with it, they immediately think about, like, it's 1980s, it's cheesy, it's over the top, it's tongue in cheek. But there's also a lot of nostalgia associated with it. And also, I feel that people only remember it from a very long ago lens, and they haven't revisited it in recent years. So I'm hoping that between the two of us, we can sort of get people to go back and rewatch this movie with a different viewpoint and perhaps come away with a newer appreciation for it.
It gets a lot of flack, and it's not a great movie. This is not like this is my top 10 movies favorite list that you would have, your desert island list, if you will.
You're right.
But I think it gets a little more flack than it deserves. And I don't know that the people who are attached to it, who acted in it, which we'll talk about, who basically sort of cringe when they remember this as part of their movie bibliography, if you will. I don't think it's honestly that bad. It does have a cult classic status for a reason.
Even Stephen King himself famously does not like this movie, but we'll get in a little bit as to probably why he feels that way now in retrospect.
He's basically said it's the reason he hasn't directed another movie.
Yeah, they say, yeah, why haven't you made another movie? And he said, just watch Maximum Overdrive. So this film is based on a short story from Stephen King's collection, Night Shift. And my friend Terry Lynn Koop and I discussed Night Shift quite in depth on an episode of this season. Go back and check that out. Famously, she was not a fan of the story. And the funny thing is, I had not read it in quite a number of years. I had some vague memories of it. So in preparation for this episode, I went back and reread it and came away feeling very chilled by it. I don't know what it was. It might have been because I was getting ready to fall asleep. And I was just kind of in that sleepy mode and reading this sort of chilling story. But also, it's just one of those stories that, you know, I've used the phrase lean and mean a lot to describe a lot of King's earlier works throughout the season. But I have to say that this one makes that feel like an understatement, because it's like a more of like a very brutal vignette than a story per se, because it begins in the middle of the action.
Right.
The story opens up. We're in this diner truck stop. We have bodies already strewn about the parking lot. There's one lying in the ditch.
Cars are crashed and flipped over.
Yeah, yeah. So things have already happened, right?
The trucks are already circling the truck stop diner, and you get this sense that there's a pack of them lying in wait for a human to come out. Like, they're just kind of parked there. So you're very much thrown right into the thick of everything. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's not even entirely clear at first until it's made starkly clear that there are no drivers in these trucks.
That's true.
But he gets there very quickly. And already they're kind of like, you know, the power's still on. They're talking about how much food they have. And, you know, we could hole up in here for a month. And they've been trying to reach people, reach stations on the radio. That's on the fritz. They can't get any connection to the outside world. They're just isolated here in this place. And we don't have any explanation whatsoever as to what's caused this. We don't have anything, right? So
right.
I think Dave, the main character, I think he... Is he a short order cook in this one, or he's just there? I think he's just there.
Like, we don't really know what his place is. He's just there because there's the counterman, as he's referred to.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Works there. You have Snodgrass, who's the salesman, who is off pretty quickly.
Yes.
And then you have the young man, Jerry, and his girlfriend. And there's a trucker, and that's it. Like, it's not a lot of characters compared to the movie. It's just this very, like you said, tight, economic little story with as few characters as possible to make it feel like you have a group here.
Yeah. And King wrote this story and published it in an issue of Cavalier magazine in 1973. This predates Carrie. This is a very old story. King was still a pretty young man when he published this thing.
Definitely his template for automobiles going wild, right?
Right, right.
Minds of their own, possession.
Yeah, and what I really love about it is the fact that there are no real explanations, because, again, it's that thing of, like, don't show too much, let the brain fill in the rest, and that's where the horror kind of comes in. There is an early attempt to go and try to secure water, because the power does go out. Really, right after they discover that, oh, we could last for about a month here, power goes out. We better get some water, because the water pump is electrically powered as well.
Which is very vivid. They're going to get buckets and get it out of the toilet tank.
Yes.
Because David, the narrator, whatever his name is, says, you know, it's still clean water. Did that bother you? Like, obviously, if you're in a survival situation, you're not going to worry about that.
Right.
But even though it's like toilet bowl adjacent, I would have to really struggle to drink that water.
Like, the inside of a toilet bowl, in a lot of cases, it's very mineral lined and it's just
rusty.
Yeah. No, thank you. But yeah, it is one of those things, like, we gotta gather all the resources. So they go out to get water from the toilet tanks and they barely make it back because a truck finds them and almost mows them down and does some damage, I think, to the structure.
I want
to
say it grazes the building or the door, something like that. It's kind of that very action scene moment where they leap through at the last minute.
Yeah.
And which you get in the movie as well. You get some of those, like, last minute dodges.
And it was kind of sad because they went out with two buckets and they came back with barely any water as they were trying to get back in.
Sloshing around.
They were like, hardly worth it. Hardly worth the effort, I think was what the phrase he used.
And this really reminds me of The Mist, where they're trapped in this building and it's a different kind of horror that's outside, but they're trying to do this rescue relief effort.
Right.
And it goes awry. Not as badly as in The Mist, but it definitely has that same feeling to it.
And different types of personalities and everything that all kind of combine. In a way, it does feel very much like that very early template. King starting to play with these ideas of multiple people trapped together in crisis and how they behave. And
right.
But this story manages to pull that off in less than like 10 pages. I mean, this is such a short story. So they eventually come to the point where the trucks start communicating in Morse code and they're out of fuel. You know, of course, then there's the ultimate debate. Oh, well, we just let them die, right?
Right.
But the problem is a new friend has joined the party, Mr. Bulldozer.
That's right.
And they realize that if they don't do what the trucks want, then the bulldozer's just going to destroy the building and then they'll all die. So yeah. They ultimately decide to start fueling the trucks. And this is what I really love, the way he describes like the effort that goes into this. And the movie kind of shows this in a montage to a certain extent. But I love how in the short story that they were out there fueling these trucks for so long. They were draining all the tanks and they were getting blisters on their hands that were like rupturing. It was just very graphic the way
and
he
fumes
described
in
it.
Their eyes, like not being able to like keep their eyes open, and they're getting dizzy. And you're right, it does cover that a little bit in the movie, but it's just a little more visceral with the short story version of it. And you really kind of feel the sense of it. And the other thing I loved is, I think it's the counterman who's basically like, if we do this for them, we're going to be like their slaves.
Yes.
Like
yes.
We are going to basically be in indentured servitude to these machines. And they don't really explore that angle in the movie, but I thought that was just a very striking way to put it, that we would basically be enslaved by these machines, not just doing their bidding. And they get into that in more detail, which I think we'll get at when we get to the end of the story.
He had a vision or envisioned being forced to work on assembly lines and building more of them.
Can I say this quote? Because I thought it was so good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
He says, and if I close my eyes, I can see the production lines in Detroit and Dearborn and Youngstown and Mackinac, new trucks being put together by blue collars who no longer even punch a clock, but only drop and are replaced.
Oh, God.
And he talks about this whole vision where trucks are being churned out and they flatten the world so that there's no way to escape the trucks. There's no place to hide. There's no cliff to go down. There's no mountain to climb. It'll just be this whole flat ball that is run by the machines. And it's just very, very striking. And
this is a very bleak ending too. And the best part is, of course, as the trucks are lining up for miles up the road, and of course, fuel tankers show up to refill the fuel tanks at the gas station so that they can keep pumping. He looks overhead and sees an airplane flying across the sky, and he just laments that there's probably nobody flying it.
Can I quote this one too?
Yes.
Two planes are leaving silver contrails etched across the darkening eastern horizon. I wish I could believe there are people in them.
Oh, oh, so good.
I love his language in this. I think it's what makes it so striking is it's just very visceral, visual imagery that he creates, again, with this economy and this just tightness of language. You see it and you feel it. And we've talked a lot about King's works and how sometimes they can be a little bloated with extras. And I feel like he really shines with his short stories. And I know we're going to talk about more of them, but that to me is just where his power really comes out. Sure, he can tell these sweeping epics, which are amazing as well. But there's just something about this, like you said, a frightening vignette?
Yes, yes.
a nightmare brutal, vignette?
A brutal,
yeah.
Yeah, brutal vignette.
Yes, very brutal. And it's great. And we should say that I can't remember why, but the bulldozer still attacks and crashes into the building. What did they decide to still?
No, I don't think there was any hint of that. If anything, I think the bulldozer attacked the building when it was thinking that they weren't going to do it. And they're like, okay, I'll show you a little bit of what I can do. Yeah.
Because that is where Jerry, the young kid, is killed, because they make improvised Molotov cocktails and are throwing it at the bulldozer, and Jerry is killed. And then I think that's where they decide they need to do the bidding of the machines.
Right, right. And then, of course, the person in the ditch.
Snodgrass.
That was the other chilling part of that, was he was calling from the ditch. He was in much worse shape than we see in the movie, where in the movie it's the Bible salesman gets, you know, kind of bumped into the ditch. He doesn't look quite as grievously injured as... But Snodgrass is kind of messed up, so you're just kind of like...
But still that creepy someone calling from the ditch. You think he's dead like everybody else, and then you just hear this cry of pain. But in the short story, they don't do anything.
No.
And he eventually just stops crying out for help, which makes it even more bleak and feel like there's just futility in anything they would try to do, so they don't even bother. Ugh.
Right. And I honestly defy anybody to say, like, okay, yeah, we're going to fuel these trucks. I mean, I would do it. I mean, I think anybody would kind of feel like, okay, if we do it, we're buying ourselves a little time. Maybe we can think of a way out of here.
Right.
But when you see all the trucks lined up and, oh God, it just feels very futile. That was a good word for it. And, you know, I absolutely love this story. I don't think it's nearly as pulpy or schlocky as I was, you know, people were saying it was or whatever. When I went back and read the actual story, I was like, this is a damn good little story mm-hmm. here.
Absolutely.
If anything, it felt about 50 years ahead of its time because, you know, back then, everything was very manual, very analog.
Yep.
In today's world, everything in a vehicle, a car, a truck, a plane, whatever, is basically a rolling computer. They're all controlled by software.
Especially electric vehicles. I mean, yeah, even to yeah. a greater extent.
But yeah, so, you know, my husband, Ken, he works in the trucking industry, and his main job is administering the mobile data terminals that the truckers at his company have to use to log mileage and hours of service, scan manifests, and sort of monitor the truck's other attributes, you know. And on more than one occasion, he's received calls from drivers who are certain their trucks are basically possessed.
Oh, geez.
And yeah, like they're all the time. And the software itself in these things is very quirky and buggy, and it's job security as far as these guys are concerned. But so we had a lot of fun watching these, and I think he had a lot of fun too. But I did say, like, my advice to you next time someone calls in with a complaint about the truck's computer and they ask what's wrong, like, you just say, fucked if I know, Bubba. Fucked if I know. Which
amazing.
Is one of the best lines from the movie. But I also feel like it's been adapted twice now. And we'll talk about the other adaptation toward the end here. But I feel like this story could really use a reboot. I feel like they could remake this film under today's circumstances and it would be pretty great.
So do you know who floated that same idea?
Stephen King?
look to the younger generation of kings.
Oh, Joe Hill?
So Joe Hill, his son, has floated the idea. I think he was asked if he would direct a movie, and he basically said he would like to do a remake of Maximum Overdrive / Trucks.
Oh, my God.
And to your point, modernize it to current day technology and what mm-hmm. that might look like with automated cars and self-driving cars and just all the, like you said, all the new computerized technology and software that are built into vehicles. And I thought that was very interesting. So apparently he's ready to do it if someone's willing to fund it, make it happen.
So Maximum Overdrive had a pretty decent budget for 1986 when it mm-hmm. was made. It had a $10 million budget, right? And so in today's money, I mean, that's, you know, a lower budget action movie is usually around 35 to 40 million. Mm-hmm. So I honestly think they could pull it off. The movie that Edgar Wright made a few years ago, Baby Driver, it's a big, you know, practical effect car chase / heist film with a lot of great driving scenes, a lot of vehicles. And he made that for $35 million. And I feel like it's absolutely doable and should be done. So, and with Joe doing it, yeah, that'd be great.
Absolutely. And there's kind of a precedent for it. Do you remember when Child's Play got remade recently?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think it was a great remake, but it did update the idea of this Chucky doll rather than this little kind of pull string toy yeah. that was the original in the 80s. It has the built-in software now, which a lot of those interactive dolls have. And so there's a precedent for taking this classic and giving it a modern twist. And the fact that it's Stephen King's son, who's also a very accomplished, successful author, which mm-hmm. would be his first directing debut. It's a very fascinating story. It's kind of like a Will the son do what the father was not able to do? Kind of a deal.
Joe is pretty famously not coked out of his mind. He's actually pretty level-headed dude. So I think he wouldn't kind of fall prey to that whole thing. The movie experience when he talks about it, that was sort of what he says. It's like he was just coked out of his mind. Didn't know, feel like he knew what he was doing half the time. His good friend and legendary director, George Romero, was on the set quite often and helped King out, I think, in a lot of ways, give him a lot of advice. And I think in some ways is, you know, could be credited for some of the film's interesting shot work and craft. This movie is way better crafted than I think people tend to give it credit for. If they're watching it from today's perspective, I want to back that up a little bit, because I feel like today's younger generation appreciates movies from the 80s probably more than people from our generation do, that we grew up with them. And so we're like, you know, they would like the special effects. But now everybody's gotten so saturated with CGI that when we see something that uses a lot of practical effects, we tend to feel like, oh, this is real. This is, you know, we appreciate it more. And I think younger people are the same way. They grew up in the world of CGI, so they feel very desensitized to it. And you know, so I think they even appreciate it, which is why I think younger generations would like this movie, probably more than, say, people our age who talk about it, like, you know, kind of in a more cynical way. So I feel like they definitely should watch this more, and they could be watching it more. I was on YouTube doing research and saw a lot of YouTubers, younger people, like early 20s, talking about this movie and loving it. Like, they love this movie. So the cult status of it is holding up, I think.
It's not just like an 80s nostalgia when you lived it. It's actually reaching a newer generation who appreciates it for what it is, which is, I think, an ultimate test of time, because you're not going to have any of those memories. You're going to probably base it solely on its merits alone and your experience with it, rather than, I remember how great it was. Because I mean, when did you first see this movie? Do you remember?
I want to say it was like the summer of 87 or 88. I was, I was down in South Carolina visiting my aunt, and she had the VHS, and we had a lot of scary movies on, and that was one of them. And I had the image of the Green Goblin just burned in my mind. And I remember other aspects of it. I remember it being kind of creepy for me. Like, I don't honestly remember watching it after that until I saw it one time when you were out here visiting, probably about, what, 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and you popped it on the TV and we started watching it, and I was like, oh my God, this movie is great. You know, I just like, this is so much fun. I had a few little quibbles with it, but overall I was like, I was hugely entertained by it. So yeah. I wasn't at all creeped out by it, but if anything, I just noted at that point the very over the top kind of, like, again, tongue-in-cheek nature of the dialogue. I mean, it even starts with Stephen King in a cameo, right, popping his card into the ATM, and immediately pops up and says, "You are an asshole."
Yeah. And it's just like, asshole, 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 asshole.
It yeah, and he's like, honey, this machine's calling me an asshole. Or what did
this
it say?
This machine just called me an asshole.
Yeah. And then it just starts from there. And it's just hilarious. And then all these other great set pieces that happen along the way that live in the mind. But I first saw it. Yeah. I was probably about 8 or 9, I guess, I saw it. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I've told this story probably 2 or 3 times on your podcast as well as on my other one, because I've referenced this movie quite a bit. So I'm glad we finally actually get to talk about it for real. But when it was in the theater, my mom took my brother and I. My brother's 4 years older. So, gosh, I can't remember. This came out in 86, right?
Yeah.
So I would have been about 7 years old. And so we go in, and I remember the woman at the ticket counter was like, "Are you sure they're going to be okay seeing this movie?" And my mom said, she points to my brother and says, you know, "He'll be fine." And she points to me and says, "And he'll just close his eyes." That's the vivid memory I have of going in to watch this movie, and I loved it. I was thoroughly entertained by it. I was not scared by it at all, despite all of the blood and gore and a kid getting run over by a freaking steamroller. Like, there's a lot of visceral scenes, and as a kid, I loved it, because you know what? I thought about this. It's going to be a very gender binary term, but I do feel like this is a boys movie, if you will, in the sense that it's big trucks and vehicles and gasoline. And like, there's just something about it like that has a very boy sensibility to it, which I think is why I loved it so much as a kid.
Right.
And even though those aspects don't speak to me in the same way as an adult, I mean, I still see them there. It's very much of an era and of a type, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah. What I really love, too, is I went back and I watched the movie trailer for it with Stephen King himself.
Oh, it's so weird.
It's so weird. He comes out, right, and he's not wearing his signature Coke bottle glasses, and he's got a beard. He's looking very... Yeah. Well, he's got his cocaine physique going on, you know, you could definitely tell.
Like a black background.
Yeah. And then the Green Goblin truck is behind him. And the music playing is actually the music that was featured in John Carpenter's Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Oh. So
they borrowed that music for it, which I found fascinating because John Carpenter wrote the music for that as well. And so it just gives it that additional little bit of flair. And yeah, he says, you know, for years I've been, you know, watching Hollywood make my movies. And, you know, this time I want to do it my way. And if you want to get it right, you got to do it yourself. And I want to see people to see a Stephen King movie the way Stephen King would do it, essentially, which is just hilarious in retrospect. Right.
And doesn't he kind of bill it as like a chilling movie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which totally isn't.
No, it is not.
Oh, man.
They tried really hard to bill it that way. And even I think one of the posters had Stephen King as like a puppet master, and he's holding like a marionette thing, and it's got strings attached to the characters, like
amazing.
Stephen King's pulling the strings. There's a lot of great promotional art surrounding the movie that does not, of course, match the final output of
the film. Right, because he kind of refers to it as a moron movie. So he kind of went in intending to make a really over-the-top schlocky movie. So it's like, well, lean into that. But I guess at the time, because he was so overbilled as a horror author, and that was his niche,
they thought that would get butts in the seats.
That would
right?
get butts in the seats, yeah.
Yeah. And at the time, this film was... This was some great trivia that I found. So it was being filmed alongside, at the same time, the film Blue Velvet, which was David Lynch's film starring Dennis Hopper. It is one of the weirdest, wackiest, trippiest, messed up movies you'll ever see. And it was because both films were produced by Dino De Laurentiis, who owned the production company that it was originally going to be MGM. Dino took it over, formed his own company. And so these were two movies that were released under the banner of that new production company.
That's right.
And the funny thing is that the cast members from each film were sort of hanging out with each other in between takes and stuff. And to me, it's just like, that is one of the weirdest 1980s things of all time. When you think about probably like, for those who haven't seen Blue Velvet, one of the trademarks of it is Dennis Hopper plays this guy who is regularly sucking like some kind of drug through a mask, like a face mask in a like a tank of some kind.
Okay.
It's like some kind of helium-y kind of thing, but it like makes him trip his balls off. And so I'm just imagining like Dennis Hopper with that mask on his face, like with the Green Goblin in the background or something.
Right.
Just like, you know, or Stephen King snorting a pile of coke like fucking Scarface. It would just be one of the best things. But I imagine hanging out on the set of either of these movies with this going on would just be hilarious. But King, he had a few things he wanted. He had a very distinct vision. But what ended up happening, like, first of all, he reached out to AC/DC, asked, like, you know, said, I'm a huge fan, love you. And I guess he like sang one of their songs at like some kind of event that they were attending. And he kind of won them over by doing that. And they didn't want to do a cameo, but they definitely agreed to do the soundtrack. And so their album, Who Made Who, is basically the film soundtrack they made for the film. But the whole billing of that album was messed up, too, because they didn't even when it was released, it was billed as a greatest hits album or something and not the soundtrack for the movie. It's so bizarre. Everything about this is so, like, behind this movie is just kind of hilarious and weird, right?
Right.
So you have AC/DC doing the soundtrack for this because they like Stephen King and King likes them. Well, for the lead, he wanted Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen.
Not Emilio Estevez, but Dino De Laurentiis was not, he wasn't a forward thinking man. He had no fucking clue who Bruce Springsteen was. So, and at that time in 1986, I mean, Bruce was kind of a household name. We're doing, like, you know, Dancing in the Dark, Born in the U.S. I mean, he was pretty much a superstar by this point. And King has always been a big Springsteen guy. I mean, the title of his book, The Stand, was a reference to a Springsteen song. I mean, it's just, Springsteen is a big influence on King. So I can imagine, like, a young Springsteen, you know, with a machine gun, like, fighting off trucks in some way. I think it would have been awesome. But Emilio Estevez was coming off his huge breakthrough with Breakfast Club, and he was kind of a household name and a famous face. And, you know, so they brought him in instead. And they said from that point, King just kind of lost interest in the project. He wasn't nearly as, like, dedicated to it. He started to feel, I think, a little, like, oh, he's not getting the vision that he wanted. And so I feel like he just kind of, like, at that point, the cocaine was flowing, like, fuck it, let's just get through it. You know, I think there might have been an element of that going on. So, but I feel like Estevez was good, though. Like, I don't have a problem with Estevez's role in this. I mean, I think he was okay.
I think as the acting goes, he was not, I mean, a standout by any stretch, but I don't think he did a poor job. I don't know that Emilio's ever done a poor job acting. I think he's always, even when he's been in movies that have been less than, you know, minute work, right? Like, it's not a...
But get this, in 2017, Emilio Estevez was named Hollywood's most profitable actor, meaning that he always had the biggest return on investment in every film that he was ever in. And probably because he didn't command a huge salary, but every movie he was in made more than its money back. So, I mean, Emilio has a pretty good track record. You don't see him much at all anymore. I don't think he's really doing much of anything, but I think it was a sound investment at the time. And he was a big name and a big face at that point in the 80s. So I honestly feel like that was a great casting choice.
I've never heard anyone criticize this movie because of his acting. Ever. No. That's never been a factor. So, no. Yeah, I think by all accounts, he did a good job on this movie, even though he may not be proud of the the movie now. And he's not. Like, I don't know what anyone attached to this movie is. King himself, Yeardley Smith, like, basically anybody is kind of like, Laura Harrington, who plays Brett. Like the female lead, if you will, like they all just kind of, like, smile and, oh yeah, I did that movie. But
you know what's great is if you go on the YouTube and watch some of these making of videos, you have people in the comments that worked on the film. I saw one from the makeup guy.
Makeup artist, yeah.
Yeah, and there was another one from a guy who drove some of the trucks around and worked on them and stuff like that and said fun memories. And so a lot of people worked on this movie from the tech side seem to enjoy their time doing it. Cause why not? I mean, you're working with big old trucks. I know there were a lot of mechanical issues. A lot of these trucks were remote controlled.
Right.
And as soon as one would get fixed, another one would break down and it would just slow down the whole process.
Yeah.
But they did a damn good job.
And what I should say too, we should clarify, this wasn't like everyone on set was coked out. Like, there was a giant table and everyone's doing lines. No one had any clue at the time that King was on cocaine.
No. King was a functional addict for the most part. Yeah.
And someone's imagination, I could see it, like, it's just this huge coke fest and everybody's just, like, blitzed out of their mind. And that is not what happened on this movie. I kind of looked into it, not half expecting it, but curious. Not the case at all. It was very under wraps. Like you said, he was very functional about it. People did apparently notice he was drinking a lot while doing the movie. Like, that was noticed. I don't know how much people thought it affected his abilities, but it was noted that, like, hey, when he's on his eighth bottle of beer by, like, you know, 10 a.m., something seems a little off. So
very true. And I think I remember him reading something from him at another point that said that he could see directing another movie in a, from a sober place. I think part of his shame of this film is knowing that he made it when he was just in a very bad place with his addictions.
That makes sense.
And I feel like he looks at it through that lens and kind of doesn't have the kindest view of it. And he, you know, so I think part of him probably just regrets the circumstances under which he made the film. And any artist, I think, is allowed to feel that way about their product. I mean, it definitely shouldn't affect how the audience views it. If we enjoy it, or if the people enjoy it, they should, you know, be able to. King doesn't have to like it. Just there, I think there's just plenty to like here. Like, for instance, from the get-go with the pop machine, okay, the soda machine at the baseball game, the little kids. This is so classic Stephen King. Like, this is something, so many set pieces from this movie I could see reading in a Stephen King book. It, because it's one of those things, it's like, they're so absurd and over the top, but it's like straight out of his brain. You just recognize it as him.
Right.
And so, yeah, the baseball coach goes to the soda machine to get kids something to drink, and then it starts firing soda cans out at him. And it's kind of over the top on the way the acting's done. But at the same time, it looks painful.
Oh, sure.
And then the kids come up to check on him and they start getting fired on. And then they all run away. And then, like, cut to the next shot and you got a steamroller busting through this fence.
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere, just because we're going to do that. And then they show a kid getting rolled over.
You see his head go under the press, the steamroller. You see it go under, like, it's, I mean, obviously it's a dummy, but, you know, it's, you see it. It's not off scene. You don't see the steamroller approach and then it cuts away to someone's reaction.
No, and interestingly, that scene was supposed to be a lot bloodier. Like, King had a whole squib kind of situation.
He had a blood bag, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it exploded at kind of the wrong time. It made it look like the kid's head exploded. He thought it was great. They had it in the movie, and then the studio was like, no, we're not keeping this.
I mean, he had to do everything to avoid an X rating on this. Like, that's how, back in the day, X didn't mean it was light porn, right? It meant it was above, well, gee, was this when PG-13 existed? I don't think it did just yet. I think that was 87.
It was on the verge.
Yeah. So, yeah, this one ends up getting above an R at that point. So he has to really scale it back in order for that. It's a great scene. I do want to back up a little bit just to say that you, offline, when we were talking about this, said a very great way of describing the short story to this movie. Because I'm like, you know, famously, Stephen King does not like the adaptation of The Shining, right? He hates what Kubrick did. He went and tried to make his own version, and it was terrible.
Right.
But here you have a situation where King veers pretty far afield tonally from his own short story work. And the great thing that you said to me is, like, the short story is almost a template because it's so small. It's just this brutal vignette.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't turn a brutal vignette into a movie. It's at best a short film. So you have to obviously expand things out, make the world bigger, more cast. And it's just interesting to me that he did that, but went in such this over-the-top, campy, pulpy kind of tone. I think it works, but I'm really curious where that came from. Was it the Coke? Was it... You know, he wanted to try something different because this is still when he had that, I won't say stigma, but definitely that persona of being only horror. And he's like, well, I'll do it, but not completely in a scary way. I'll do it in a tongue-in-cheek way. I don't know if he's ever mentioned.
No, I don't think I've seen that at all, like why he decided to go in this particular direction, because he very well could have made a much scarier film.
Certainly.
I mean, that leads me to a fun little tidbit that I discovered when researching this as well. The Evil Dead franchise would not exist if not for Stephen King and working on this film
That's
at the
right.
time that he was.
That's
because
right.
he loved the first Evil Dead movie, and he heard that Sam Raimi and the studios were having trouble making a sequel. And so he brought it up to Dino De Laurentiis and said, you know, let's see what we can do here. And that's how Evil Dead 2 happened. And people widely agree that Evil Dead 2 is probably the better of the movies. A lot of people share that opinion anyway. I'm not going to speak for everybody on that. I personally prefer it as well, although I love the first film. But if he had not been working on that movie at the time with Dino, Evil Dead wouldn't have existed. And I'm like, and then I found myself going, maybe that's kind of what he was going for, because the Evil Dead has a bit of black comedy. There is an over-the-top absurdity to it where you kind of have to laugh to let a little bit of the tension out. But the imagery is terrifying. So that's where he missed the mark, I think. I feel like part of him wanted to do something like a Sam Raimi horror, which if you see any of Sam Raimi's horror movies, I already mentioned Evil Dead, Army of Darkness, but also Drag Me to Hell. That's another classic, you know, where it's gross and scary and hilarious, all in equal measure. And it's so fun to watch. So I sometimes wonder, like, was he trying to aim for like a Raimi-esque kind of thing? And he just missed the mark because of various studio issues and whatever else was going on at the time in his life that just kind of made him miss that mark. Another thing that I love, this is a bit of a shout to overall multiverse fans, is the number 19, because the Earth passes through the comet's tail. That's the explanation King makes, right?
At the outset, right? Like at the very beginning, we know this is caused by a comet. Yeah.
And we had none of that, of course, in the short story. So this is what he drums up, which is goofy in and of itself. Feels kind of pulpy.
Very goofy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that was on June 19th, 1987 was when that happened, when it was set. And June 19th of 1999, Stephen King was hit and nearly killed by a van while he was on a walk. The number 19 has been hugely prominent throughout most of his writing career. Dark Tower fans will know. And he uses 19 as like to mean fucked up, essentially. Like, oh, we're going full 19, like some of the characters will say. So I found that really interesting. But we have to talk about the Green Goblin truck. This thing.
Absolutely.
It's the movie's main villain. Do you have anything about what made them decide to even use this particular set piece? Why this Green Goblin face?
I don't know. All I remember is that he said he wanted the Green Goblin face on the front of the truck. Like, he saw the Green Goblin, and I don't know if it was in a comic book or a movie or something.
I think it was a comic book, yeah.
And he just loved that visual and put it on the front of a truck, because it's not a thing. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that on a vehicle. But what it does is it creates this very compelling villain. It gives this otherwise personalityless truck an actual face. And it's got the glowing red eyes, which is so cool. I mean, because if you think about it, that's the face. It already has a voice. They're honking their horns when they're upset. Later, they're doing Morse code. That carries over from the short story. And you had picked on something I did too, which, and it only happens once in the movie, but you see a couple of the, it's the trucker Andy who drives the Green Goblin truck and Amelia's character, Bill, which I just want to say once again, Stephen King loves to name his characters Bill. There are so many freaking Bills. It's like the fourth time it's happened.
It's true.
It's going to come up again, I swear. So like the truck is just kind of taken off by itself and they're not sure what happens and they're talking and the rear view mirror turns to bring the characters into view. And it serves two great purposes. From a filming standpoint, it's just a cool shot.
Yes.
But it's also like the eyes of the truck. Like the trucks are watching you. Like that's its means of doing it. And so what's so cool about the main truck is it has eyes, it has the voice, the mouth, and it has the face. And it even has like the, what is the name on the side of the truck?
It's Happy like Toys.
Happy Toys with a Z.
Yes, yes.
And then there's like a creepy looking clown. So it has a couple of faces.
We get a little Pennywise kind of homage. It is what it feels like.
You're right, it is. My goodness. And so I couldn't find out where it came from, only like what the inspiration was, but it's so brilliant. It's a great little touch.
It's a great way to sort of anthropomorphize the trucks a little more.
It's a much better way to say what I was saying. Yes.
No, you're totally.
Succinct.
I was just like, I was curious, like if there was anything out there like in specific, but I think that face and the way he's Green Goblin is portrayed in the comic book looks, identical. And the cool thing is that this particular Green Goblin face from the movie, it was heavily damaged, and it ended up...
Well, they kind of blow it up at the end. Spoilers. Yeah.
And so, but it ended up getting passed around to different buyers, like after the movie, and it sat in someone's garage and in their backyard. And then eventually the latest owner, they restored it, spent a lot of years like rebuilding it. And then he would drive it around. He put it on his own truck and would drive it around to various horror and comic conventions.
Oh, that's amazing. That'd be so cool to see in person.
It really would. And I think it is honestly one of the best things about this movie, because I feel like if anybody remembers anything from this movie, it's that face. It's that truck with that face on it. That is an icon.
Yeah.
So I feel like a movie that's truly bad, I don't think that would endure. I think of movies that are truly, truly awful or ones that you really just want to forget or that you can forget. They're just forgettable. I think to me, that's the sign of a lower quality film for me, is that I don't remember hardly anything of it. I can say, though, maybe that's not always true, but this one, I think it sticks in the mind because it's an effective horror device.
Well, there's another amazing face that shows up unexpectedly in this movie.
Yes. Oh my God.
So to set the tone a little bit, as Allison said, you know, the first thing we have is Stephen King going up to that ATM, and then you have the drawbridge scene. That's like the big opener where the drawbridge goes up on its own. I believe there's a van that has AC/DC on the side.
Yes.
And that's when you get their song, Hell's Bells. Oh, Hell's Bells. Oh, it's so good.
The music is so good. I just love AC/DC. It is freaking fantastic.
Amazing. So you get that. And then we go to the main setting, which is the Dixie Boy truck stop, which is so good. You got the owner, Bubba, who calls everybody Bubba.
That's right.
How amazing, right? Where you just call everybody by your own name. He's like, don't cost me today, Bubba. It's so ridiculous.
He loves himself very
much.
It is
amazing. And so you start to see, like, this is where the characters are all kind of coming together. And there's this point where there's a guy in the arcade, and the arcade machines are going wild.
Yes.
And suddenly this pinball machine, kind of the glass shatters, and the guy in there goes, yo mama. It's like the most ridiculous response. So I look back at the casting list. Who was this, Allison?
That was none other than Giancarlo Esposito.
Oh my of God. Gus Fring.
Gus Fring of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and The Mandalorian. And I mean, he's been in so many great things. Yeah. And so I had no clue until my husband went and looked it up when he was watching it with me. He was like, oh my God, that's Gus Fring. I was like, no way. We had to like rewind it and go back.
Very young, very young.
I did not recognize him at until I went back and looked, and I was like, oh yeah, I see him in there now, but not at first glance. So that was truly amazing. I think we can almost credit Stephen King for discovering Mr. Esposito. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what his previous acting credits were.
I did look back because I was curious. He had done a lot before that. So I wanted this to be his like first role.
Okay, but sadly
not.
Enough.
Yeah, sadly not. He can't quite get that honorific, but...
Well, it's cool that they got him for that little part in that movie. So
I will say his only line was pretty amazing. Yo mama.
And also it was the cigarette machine was also... so he had a pocket full because of cigarettes and you're right.
Okay, so first off, children, a cigarette machine was an actual dispenser of cigarettes, yes. Much like you might get a drink or a snack out of a machine. I remember you would pull the lever, too, under the pack you wanted, and it would just pop one out. So hilarious. Yep. But so he's packing himself with – oh, that's right, because I think the change is coming out, too.
Yeah.
So he's basically like he just won the jackpot in Vegas. He's stuffing himself with change and cigarettes. But then one of the machines ends up mesmerizing him and then electrocuting him.
And they said some of the imagery used in that with the mesmerizing him is from popular like hypnotizing imagery, apparently.
Yeah, it's like this almost 3D thing that's coming at you out of the screen.
If he had just taken his stuff and went back out, he'd be fine. He could have had all the smokes in the world.
Oh my God.
No.
I mean, he looked loaded down like ridiculous, like Kramer did in that episode where he has all the change and he's going to the dry cleaner or whatever.
Yeah.
It's insane.
So many great moments like that. And also, we can't let this escape without talking about Miss Wanda, because she's the waitress at the diner.
The scene.
Okay, so she's got a couple. So the first scene really in the beginning, which is just great, is she's, you know, serving up some food off a griddle that's clearly not very hot, but then an electric knife is inexplicably just there.
Right. There.
And it just turns on and starts cutting into her arm.
Oh. Very, a lot of blood, very, yeah. Again, you see it all. It is not a cutaway.
No, not at all.
So to speak.
And so then it falls to the floor and it's still on. It's not plugged in. And Emilio Estevez's character comes up with a hammer and just bashes the living shit out of it. So that was a first sense for them. Like, okay, things are getting weird. And I think the thing with the arcade, wasn't really clear that the trucks were doing anything just yet at this point.
This is a weird breakaway of the movie where it is all machines are doing something. Like, it's the drawbridge, it's the ATM, it's the knife. And we learn later it's the soda machine and the lawnmower. It's like all these machines, except you realize there's one classification of machine that doesn't seem to be affected at all.
Cars?
Cars.
Yeah, there are plenty of cars parked out front.
Because like the newlywed couple, which is Curtis, and we need to talk about them. Curtis and Connie, they're driving around a lot. They're being chased by a truck. Bubba's car is parked out front until it gets smashed toward the end. Nothing happens with that. Like, for some reason, cars aren't doing anything, but everything else seems to be maximum overdrived. It's an interesting choice.
The rules seem to be, unevenly applied. And I do wonder if that was a choice or just one of those things where it was like, we had these grand ideas and then we get part of the way through and we realize, okay, we don't have everything we need to make this work. Or, you know, again, I suspect there were probably some studio politics going on behind the scenes, like wrap this up and, you know, you're getting out of hand. I don't know. I mean, I would love to know a little more about what the communication was like between King and the studio executives, because I definitely feel like there were some heads being butted there, or they were probably feeling like, okay, this guy's a total rookie and we gave him essentially a pretty big check to work with. For a guy, he'd written a lot of screenplays at that point, but he'd never directed before. And so it was quite a bit of trust they put into him to sign him onto this thing.
I mean, Dino really wanted him to do it. He kind of felt like let the master himself tell his own story. But you're right. I mean, for somebody who's never directed before, it's kind of that's a big undertaking. And King even admitted like it was even harder than he expected. And I think you're right. Having George Romero there was probably very instrumental. His advice and kind of guidance was probably key to this movie being as good as it ended up being.
Yeah. But then Wanda, she starts kind of losing it a little bit. She's not taking this whole weird machine apocalypse very well. So we get a little ghost of Wanda in the short story with a woman,
the girlfriend
in there. She's a, this is impossible. We made them. But it's a very calm statement. But as soon as I read that in the story, I just busted out laughing because I was like, oh my God, that's where that came from.
Well, Wanda starts off a little understated where she's like, we made them. But then she ratchets up to about a 12.
They can't. We made them.
Now, look, honey, you've gone and hurt yourself. Now, come on, sweet thing.
Don't you sweet thing me.
I wanted you, baby. Just
they can't. We made them. You can! We made you! We're just some loyalty, you beauty thing!
We made you!
We made you!
And the whole, like,
full body, full
gesticulations.
Oh my gosh.
Are just.
You have to see them. You have to see them to believe.
I would love to see King's direction of this scene where he's just telling her, just throw it all out there. You know, I just feel like. And again, that moment reads like something that would be in a Stephen King book.
Mm-hmm.
And it would, and you could see him almost describing it.
I mean, it kind of was, again, to a very understated extent in the short story, it was there. The sentiment is very understandable, right?
And I like what it's trying to say. And I like where she ultimately went, because I definitely feel like there had to be someone in this story, in this movie, that was going to lose it,
sure.
Right? Because honestly, I think in a bigger movie, there might have been a whole, there would have been like a Mrs. Carmody or, you
right.
know, somebody of that effect. So I feel like that served that purpose, but that's like probably one of the most iconic parts of the movie again is that scene. And of course it pairs very well with AC/DC's song.
Who Made Who?
Yeah. Who Made Who? So it's all coming full circle, which I really love. So, and of course, in the midst of all this, we can't not have a romantic hookup of some kind. So, you know, I wish we didn't. This is, to me, where the movie did hit the bricks a little bit.
Yeah, you're right. The beginning part is introducing all the characters, and that's a good clip. Like, it moves back and forth pretty quickly. We get to know the different characters and where they're coming from. You have the Bible yeah. salesman, whose name is, I don't know if this is mentioned, Camp Lohman. It's played by Christopher Murney. I don't remember hearing yeah. his name. They always just kind of refer to him. I don't even know what they refer to him as, the salesman, I guess. Well, Brett refers to him as the creepy salesman.
Which he was. I mean, he was copping a feel, you know, in the car.
So. She's hitching a ride with him, and he's given her this whole speech about how people have lost their way morally. The Bible is what's going to help them. But while he's doing this, he's like putting his hand on her leg and just being very touchy and pawing at her. So obviously, he's a dirtbag creep. And
right.
Brett is played by Laura Harrington, who you might know as the oldest daughter in What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Yes.
That's what I immediately remembered her from. So they arrive, and like I said, everyone's coming together. The romantic aspect that you mentioned is basically between Emilio and the Brett character. And this also mm-hmm. gets into a little bit of creepy studio notes, because
yeah.
when she shows up, she's wearing like, what would you call that? A fedora or like a mm-hmm. like a big hat? She's wearing a jacket and jeans. And partially through making the movie, Dino De Laurentiis is like, why is she wearing this much clothing? She's our female lead.
Right.
So in the story, after the Bible salesman's hit, she's like, I have to change to get – he had his hands all over me. And she changes into this like slinky sheer top and like a skirt, which she proceeds to wear for the rest of the movie because, of course – you know, she has to be this sex symbol. And then she and Emilio end up hooking up in true Stephen King fashion. We're in a crisis. Let's bang. And you're yes. right. This is the part of the movie where it does grind to a halt. The beginning
yeah.
part, it moves pretty quickly. And then this part, it's just sort of this dead zone in the middle.
And you get some sexy sax music or guitar music. It all kind of has that, you know, very cliche 1980s sex music. And of course, they're all kind of lit and with a greenish hue because the sky has got this weird
That's
green
right.
fog in it, you know, and it's just it's an odd moment to just lie there and have this like in bed moment with the world kind of ending. I just, I don't know. I feel like if this were reflected in real life, and again, we'll call it my term that I used in The Mist, crisis boning. If crisis boning must happen, I see it being like a quick turnaround in the bathroom. Like, let's go in, get it out of our systems and get the fuck back out. I mean, that's
yeah.
just if you gotta have it. But I think there was probably also some need, again, that classic, like you said, the studio notes. I really like how you put that, because I feel like there had to have been some influence there, like, we got to have a romantic scene. I don't know that we needed that, and I don't know that that's something that he might have come up with on his own. I feel like there was a little bit of...
I don't think so, but sadly, a lot of movies have that, right?
Yeah,
they
do.
They want to shoehorn in a love story where it's not needed, and it feels no. like a remnant, a vestige of old Hollywood that just won't die. And it's very refreshing when you get a movie that doesn't have it, where you gasp, have men and women acting together and they don't want to bang each other. They're just trying to do the plot. It's
just You're just like, trying to survive. And you know, it's interesting too. I mean, this movie is barely an hour and a half long. It's not
yeah.
a very long movie. And so I find it interesting too that Well, maybe they felt like they had to pad it a little bit, because if they didn't have that, the movie wouldn't even be, it would be barely an hour long. So they add these things in, but I feel like there's other things they could have done. I feel like there were probably things left on the cutting room floor that might have been better, but they went in this other direction. Because again, Stephen King directed this thing, but he didn't edit it. So
right.
A lot of the power of a film is in the editor's hands. I feel like that's why, you know, as much as we love Martin Scorsese, it's really his editor, Schoonmaker, I think is her name. I can't remember her first name all of a sudden, but she's worked with him for many, many, many years. And she makes those movies what they truly are at the end of the day. And that's the case in a lot of these. So
Evan Lottman was the editor.
Okay. Yeah. I'm very curious the editorial choices that were made here. I think there were probably some additional things. This is obviously, most directors are not given final cut in their films. Even famous ones like Ridley Scott are not given final cut. It's ultimately up to the studio and the editors and the test audiences and things like that. So I sense there is a different movie here that King wanted that didn't come out in the final wash. And to me, nothing exemplifies that more than the ending, because it feels like we hit the bricks, we're real slow, we got to have sexy times and all these other weird character building moments, and then it picks up back up again, but so fast. Like all of a sudden they found a way out through the sewers. They decided to get Bubba's weapons cache because Bubba got blown away.
Well, we should mention, so a lot of the elements that are from the short story, we've missed a lot of plot here. A lot of elements that from the short story are maintained, which is the trucks are circling and all that. And they do the Morse code wanting food, but it's not just a bulldozer that shows up. There's also this, God, what would you call it? It's like a cart with a machine gun on it.
Yes.
It's not any kind of military vehicle I've ever seen. It almost looks like those old timey rail cars where like there's like a handle on each side and you're kind of pumping it, but you remove that and you put a machine gun there. That's basically what this thing is. And so it shows up and it starts honking Morse code. Deke, who's the kid that escaped the baseball massacre, and he's the one that we kind of follow as he's riding his bike, and you see the complete mayhem in his neighborhood before he makes it to the truck stop where his dad works, who unfortunately was killed after being sprayed in the face with gasoline.
Oh God.
A very nightmare scene. But anyway, so he realizes it's Morse code, and much like in the short story, translates it, and they have to like pump all the gas. Bubba kind of wants to fight it, and he's going to, because he's got a rocket launcher. He doesn't just have a couple like semi-automatic weapons. He's got a freaking rocket launcher.
He's got a whole cache of weapons, yeah.
And they end up shooting a lot of stuff. But unfortunately, Bubba gets gunned down because he tries to stand up against these big rigs and this little military truck.
And Wanda as well, she kind of eats it after that, because she finally has her, I think it was really after Bubba died, isn't she, picks up the rocket launcher.
She picks it up and yeah, she does the whole "we made you" for a second time, yep.
Yeah, and then she gets shot, and then the rocket launcher misfires, blows up another truck, but of course doesn't really stop anything. We just have another dead body, and I think it's at that point when they're like, we need to get the hell out of here, kind of situation, because they've pumped all the gas they can pump, and unlike the short story where they are at that point of just being truck fuel slaves, they can't end the movie that way, obviously. They need to have a third act. They need to get away. Emilio Estevez's character has this whole thing where he talks about a place they could go. It's this island called Haven that no cars or anything machinery is really allowed there.
Because they basically have to survive a week, right? Like that's when the comet's supposed to have passed, and they surmise that this effect will go away.
Yeah, and I think that's another weird thing too, that they had that little bit of information, the way that that's like.
Yeah, I think they were getting little sound bites from the news and kind of putting two and two together. So it's not inconceivable, certainly.
Okay, so they were feeding them some little, they had a little info.
I think there's a little bit coming through very subtly in the story, but yeah. But they hatch this escape plan, like you're mentioning.
They do, and it's through a sewer. another 500 yards of shit coming out clean on the other side kind of moment.
Thankfully, no clowns down there either.
Stephen King just loves him some sewers, mm-hmm. Sewer action. So the remaining survivors managed to come out. And we also have an oxygen tanker that's...
We sure do. Liquid oxygen, yeah.
Yeah, liquid oxygen that comes in and just kind of like completes the job. And this is another... This will lead me to another aside as well. I love all the explosions and all the car and vehicle work in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you watch, you know, some great stunt driving. You're watching some great things crashing into each other and things getting literally destroyed. You watch in the very beginning of it, you see a truck being dropped into a river. It is just, you know, they blew some shit up. They destroyed some things in this movie. This is not, again, every time something like this would happen, I was like, that wasn't cheap. I was just like naming. I was like, each scene like this that had all these trucks, the trucks themselves, even just having those, even though they're older, sure, it's not cheap to have all that on set.
Right.
To all that fuel, all the mechanics and the drivers and all this stuff. I couldn't call this a low budget movie just because of the fact that there is a lot that happens here. I've seen a lot of low budget movies, and we'll get to the other adaptation here Certainly. Very shortly, where you really know what low budget looks like
right.
for this movie or this property, I should say. And I also want to backtrack too about the cars thing, like not being possessed or whatever. Some people theorize that, was it possible that the married couple, because we need to talk about Yeardley Smith and her and Curtis,
like, yes,
those two characters, the married couple, yep. the newlyweds.
Yeah. Curtis.
Did their car, or was he just, did it just veer out of control when he was trying to, because they wrecked, like, coming in to the truck stop.
Yeah, so they're basically trying to run the blockade, right? The trucks are circling, he notices an opening, so he wants to gun it and hit the opening, and I think he just mistimed it, and a truck hit him.
Okay. So there was nothing really happening with their car. That could have been an opportunity, but they didn't explore
it
that.
It could have, but for some reason, cars seem to be remote control cars. Unfortunately, yeah. It attacked a dog and...
And the
lawnmower. And
that yeah. whole moment of the little kid riding the bike down the street and looking at the... In his neighborhood, as you mentioned earlier.
Complete carnage.
It's complete carnage, but so Stephen King. Like, that is absolutely something. The woman hanging out of the window of the top floor of the house with her hair dryer wrapped around her neck, like... What?
Pizza delivery guy smashed into a tree and he's like hanging out of it. Yeah. And the lawnmower scene, actually, did you see there was an actual injury to
the cinematographer.
Cinematographer, thank you.
And there was a lawsuit. He sued Stephen King. They settled out of court.
He actually lost an eye.
Yeah, he lost an eye because the lawnmower went over some wood and the splinters fell out and caught him right in the face.
And he wanted to remove the blade because he's like, it's not necessary for the shot. You won't see it. King apparently, as it's told, wanted to keep it for authenticity. And then, this piece ends up flying out, hitting the cinematographer, and he lost an eye. And you can actually see shots of him posing with the cast with an eye patch. He came back.
And amazing that he did that, because I don't know that I would have been as big about it if I lost an eye on the job for something
certainly.
That was entirely preventable. And again, that's not that this doesn't happen on film sets with very seasoned film directors. We could just, again, harken back to the Twilight Zone movie incident, where it gets way out of hand and egos are flying and, you know, my vision must be realized. And maybe that's the other thing that kind of soured King on that whole experience. When you're making movies, it's a whole other mentality from making books, right. where, you know, it's largely in your own head. And when you're making a movie, it's a huge collaborative thing. And I think ego definitely comes into play a lot more strongly. So I don't know that he was cut out for it at all. I'm glad we mentioned that, because I did come across that with the cinematographer losing an eye. So that is an important thing to consider in the making of this movie. And
yeah, his name is Armando Nannuzzi.
Is he still working? Is he still alive?
Do you know? It looks like he's an Italian cinematographer, and it looks like he was working from the 1940s to the 1990s.
Oh, wow.
So he had a very long career.
I have to give some props. I think there's really good cinematography in this film. There are too many iconic shots, and even in little moments, I think in the very beginning when you are introduced to Emilio Estevez's character, there's a frame where there's sun coming in through the window blinds and the way it lights his face, where he just, Emilio looks kind of beautiful. I mean, I would never use those words normally to describe him.
Right.
He's not really my cup of tea, but he looked really like the hero shot. By the way, Bill, you know, he's a convict, like a former convict. He's a dark guy. He's not your average like white hat hero.
I think it's a fairly innocuous crime, right? It wasn't anything major.
Maybe it was like robbery. I mean, he's not on a sex offender list, but he's kind of a bad boy.
That's true. Yeah. And to your point about the cinematography, going back to the newlyweds, there's this great car chase scene where, you know, we're introduced to them. And they pull off at this stop and they find a dead guy and this truck starts basically chasing them.
Yeah.
And it's this really high speed chase down the highway. And of course, Yeardley Smith, by the way, if you had no clue who she was, as soon as you hear her voice, you're like, Lisa Simpson. So that is,
oh, for sure.
Without a doubt. She is not doing a lot of affectation or modulating of her voice to sound like Lisa. And her screaming in this movie is amazing.
Yeah.
She has this blood-curdling scream, and she has the best voice, the thing she says the most. If Wanda is, "We made you," then Connie's is, "Curtis, are you dead?" Oh, my God. "Are you dead, Curtis?" Oh, it's so great. She has another great line, which is, "Don't make me a widow on my wedding day." It's so good.
I'm just kind of bummed that she's not proud of this movie in any way, because I honestly think she's adorable, and I loved the way she talks. I loved everything about her in this movie. So, and the guy who plays Curtis,
John Short.
He had a bit of a glow up. Like he aged kind of well.
So when
I was going through the IMDb, I was like, oh damn, like, okay,
what up, John? How you doing?
Great couple, great, you know, moments between them. I feel like they definitely added, not that the movie needed a comic relief per se, but they definitely added additional lightness that it meshed well, I think, with all the other kind of bigger than life characters that we have.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you're right, that's a great way to put it, a lot of larger than life characters. The Bible salesman, Bubba Hendershot, you've got Connie, you've got Wanda, and then some of the other ones are a little more stated. What I thought was really cool too is they sort of stand in for Jerry and the girlfriend, unnamed, in the short story, right?
Right.
While they weren't married, they were the couple that came together. And ultimately, Curtis ends up going off with Emilio a lot to do like the rescue mission. Like that's when they're going to go get the Bible salesman, because they once again hear him screaming, "Help me!" But they actually crawl through the sewer in the little drain tunnel to help get him.
Oh,
it's
It's
a little too late. Yeah. But Deke, the kid, is there, who's also being attacked by. So it's a great timing moment, but he's being attacked by the Bible salesman. And so they're able to kind of get out of there. But he ends up being that assistant for the main character to do all of the little recon rescue mission work, like in the short story.
Agreed. Deke ended up kind of going on to become quite a prolific like voice actor. He also did voices in Red Dead Redemption 2. I find it.
Oh, interesting. Played by Holter Graham, by the way.
Yeah. Holter Graham and the Bible salesman guy whose name I've already forgotten.
Christopher Murney. They're both in Red Dead 2.
Yeah, they've both done Red Dead, and they both have done Grand Theft Auto 5 voices. So they're both in on Rockstar a little bit. And also, again, with Holter Graham, he did for the N, like I keep bringing this up throughout the little short story, he did the voice of Charlie. If you go on YouTube and just look for N by Stephen King, there's like this whole little animated by Marvel kind of little short film that's based on this short story N by Stephen King. It's like a great little cosmic horror thing. And he does voices for that. So these guys have like continued in some Stephen King. It just shows how Stephen King is just part of so many things, right? So the big moment comes, you know, after Bob is dead, Wanda's dead, and they need to get out of here.
The oxygen chuck crashes into the, basically, Dixie Boy truck stop, no more. Ball of flames.
Gets blown up. Great way to take care of the set when it's all said and done. A set that, by the way, was so convincing, built outside Wilmington, North Carolina, that truckers kept trying to stop at it.
Isn't it great?
And they had to like tell them like, look, this is just a movie set.
I think they were like putting it out on like the CB and everything. They're like, not a real truck stop. I thought that was a great little note.
So that, yeah, definitely speaks again to the ultimate craft, I think.
But where are our heroes going? Where are they off to? You said Haven. How are they getting there?
Yeah, Haven. They're getting there on a little boat because apparently boats have also not been affected by whatever.
Was it a sailboat? I can't remember now.
It was a sailboat.
Okay.
And I mean, you always have a little bit of a troller motor or something in a sailboat. I didn't see any other boats, any rogue boats, as opposed to rowboats or rogue boats. And so they managed to, you know, make their great escape.
There's two big final moments in this escape. You've got the ice cream truck, first off, which only makes a small appearance. I feel like you mentioned stuff maybe lost on the cutting room floor. I feel like there should be more with this ice cream truck that didn't make
it. Right.
I noticed the tune it was playing. Did you notice what tune it's playing?
It was
King of the Road.
King of the Road. Yeah, that's right.
I thought that was a great little touch because I was sitting there. This is the only watch through where I noticed that. And I'm like, wait a minute. What tune is that playing? And I was like, is that King of the Road by Roger Miller? It is. So funny.
Yeah.
So great.
I would love that. I would love that if they would just do that in other ice cream trucks. That'd be awesome.
So our heroes shoot it up. It explodes. But what you see as they're escaping is the Green Goblin truck is coming after them. So it is definitely the nemesis. It is not going to let these people get away quietly. And so you have it charging them at the marina, and Emilio Estevez pulls out that trusty rocket launcher.
It gets quickly dispatched for all its menace. True. That was the part where I'm like, they kind of took it out pretty easy. I think, you know, I would have drawn that scene out a little bit. Let the truck kind of... They did have another great little moment, though, where one of the survivors, who wasn't really named, he finds a woman dead in her car with her arm hanging out the...
Oh, that's right.
Kind of hanging out the window, and he steals her ring and somehow does not notice this big roaring motor behind him. And it just, like, creams him, right? So Green Goblin gets another little taste of blood before he eats the rocket. But the movie just literally ends at this point. They're on the boat, and then all of a sudden you get the text over the screen.
God. Talk about cheese and, factor.
Okay, here is the thing right here. Oh. It should, I don't have the exact wording, but I have a summation. First of all, this should have been a movie in and of itself. After a UFO was destroyed by a Russian weather satellite.
Air quotes.
Equipped with a laser cannon and class 4 nuclear missiles.
Yes, obviously.
Then the comet passed and everything was great. And the survivors remained survivors.
I was like, wait, a UFO? What?
A UFO? Where did the UFO come in? But you know what's funny about this whole thing is I feel like this ties into my feeling of King's somewhat disillusionment with the production process of this movie that was kind of hinted at in some of the things that I had read. And it just felt like to me, like he's just saying, fuck it. We're just throwing anything up there. This is it. This is what happened. I'm putting a UFO and nuclear missiles.
A Russian weather satellite with freaking laser beams.
It is like the most insane thing that could have come out of his brain. And I just feel like he did that intentionally. As just to like, you know what, man, just fuck it. Fuck it. You know, just we're done. You could have. So and then in a way, though, it just makes me love it even more because it's just like I you just kind of end the movie, the credits roll and you're just like, what the hell?
Yeah.
What did I just watch? This is the most bizarre kind of lovable thing. It's a piece of movie history and cult movie history that I think we would be lesser if we didn't have it. I really do.
So, it's lovable schlock. I'll say that much.
It's very much a lovable schlocky camp movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So very interesting. But we learned something that you mentioned earlier when we were going to be researching this show, did we not?
Yes, we did. We learned that there were two movies. And this one was made in 1997, starring Timothy Busfield.
Yeah.
whom I remember, well, he's been in a number of things, but I remember him most from this like sitcom drama thing from the 80s called 30 something, because mm-hmm. my mom used to watch this show. But this one was supposed to be adapted more closely to the short story,
right?
Which again, I think is kind of funny because it takes a lot of liberties as well. I didn't see a ton of the short story in this movie other than the basic premise.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like you said, template. I think these are two versions that expand on the core story, but in very different ways, in very different locations, with very different outcomes. The unifying similarities are pretty minimal. And I think there's a lot more from Maximum Overdrive that takes from the source material than Trucks does.
Yes.
And you can't even say the tone of the movie isn't less, maybe on the whole it's less cheesy, but it has two very ridiculous, over-the-top moments in it.
There are. I feel like they're almost more awkward than they are delightfully cheesy. You know what
they
I mean?
They feel out of sorts with the rest of the movie. At least there is a tonal consistency to Maximum Overdrive, love it or not. But this right. one, it felt like it was trying to take it a little more seriously, but then also it added in these really strange elements. So
yeah, so this one takes place in around Area 51. Yes. So we're already bringing in the kind of weird alien, although it also references the comet, if I'm not mistaken.
Did it? I don't remember.
I think it did. Hmm. I felt like it did. Or maybe one character, it was like the young girl character, said, oh, I think I heard on the news there was some kind of comet that was passing by. And it was just like, that was it.
What I will say for this one is they throw out a lot of potential explanations and never... Yeah. land anywhere specific. So whereas the book doesn't really get into it at all, and the movie's very blatant from the title card, like from the start, this one is in the middle where it's like, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. So yeah, that may have been one that was mentioned.
One thing I found funny, they said it takes place in Area 51. I was just in New Mexico. Didn't look very deserty. It was a little dusty, but there were a lot of trees. It was kind of green out there. I'm like, are you sure this isn't like Colorado or... possibly North Carolina, even. Oh, I think it's Canada. Kind of funny. It was filmed in Manitoba, yeah. in fact. So they set it in Area 51. This is, looks nothing like Area 51.
I don't think there's many deserts in Canada. I'm just going to go out on a, at least not a sandy traditional desert.
They're working on it. The Earth's working on it. Okay, so same kind of premise, right? Timothy Busfield plays the sort of Emilio Estevez character. But he's more plain, you know, he doesn't have the, you know, the gruff voice and, you know, I'm a bad boy who's trying to make good. He's not like that, you know.
He's a father.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a family man.
So Timothy Busfield plays Ray and his son is Logan.
Yes. And there are other characters that kind of are traveling around and end up coming to this truck stop because there's the lady who does like the Area 51 kind of tours.
Yeah, so Hope is kind of like the main female character and she's picking up these tourists. She does these little, well, she kind of runs like a hotel, right? But then they also some sightseeing type things that are Area 51 theme, like these little tours. So she picks up this like hippie guy and then this military dad.
Oh, I love that. I did like the hippie guy quite a bit.
He was pretty funny. And then there's like the army dad who's kind of estranged from his daughter, who's a little bit like, I can't even with anything right now. You know, she's somewhat in that rebellious teen phase. And I think those are your principal. You've got a couple truck drivers. You've got the old man that's the cook. But I think those are the core people that you end up getting in this story. But this is not a movie that made it on the big screen, right?
No, it was made for USA. It probably has a budget even smaller that would have been made for network TV. So, you know, if you think of Stephen King adaptations that made it to, say, ABC, like It or The Stand, this movie makes those feel like a, like almost like a James Cameron level budget.
I would say there's like five or six trucks in this.
At most. And the ones that are circling the truck stop, I would say it's mainly four. Yeah. And they're all dump trucks. Like there's, well, there's like three dump trucks. There's like a very short kind of semi. And there's like a bucket truck or a crane or something
it's
like that.
It's like a utility truck, like a electric utility truck.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then you've got, I think you've got the one truck with a short trailer, you're right. So it's like you got the one big truck, but yeah, it's very low budget.
There was like one out on the freeway. There's a couple little moments there, but for the most part, we're talking about four or five trucks. they don't seem very threatening. They don't seem very menacing. It definitely feels like they could get out. If like this feels much more escapable.
Right.
And not nearly as menacing. There was like a moment, I think it was like with the son and the young daughter of the army guy, where they got caught in like a little, what was it? Like a hole in the ground.
It's like a little drain pipe, but that's like a really interesting part. So I think she tries to escape and he goes after her and they're stuck down there. And the one of the trucks basically busts one end of the pipe. So it's almost like a drain pipe that would go under a road, right?
Yeah.
So it smashes one end so they can't get out. And then the other truck backs up and the exhaust is just blasting right into the little pipe they're in. So they're basically being just like killed by carbon monoxide poisoning slowly. And Ray's kind of freaked out. And I can't remember, but he sort of has a rapport with the trucks, a little bit like Emilio did, where they sort of have an understanding. And he's able to kind of calm them down. And basically, the kids have to crawl out of the pipe to escape. But they're basically crawling right behind the back wheels of this truck. And it's a very tense scene where it's like, one false move and that truck could back right up and they'd be smashed. That's one of the few scenes I think it did extremely well and was pretty tense.
I feel like if Stephen King were making this movie, probably one of those kids would have gotten it. They would have gotten rolled over.
Or if like it wasn't made for TV. I bet if it was, yeah, I think they'd be a little held back, obviously.
It all kind of led me to feel like, why this movie? Because I feel like this is the kind of story that really does need a little bit of money to tell. You need to be able to show these machines and really show their threat. And it's really hard to pull that off on a very limited stage like they had here. I mean, it really, thinking back to Maximum Overdrive, you really see all the areas that Maximum Overdrive really delivered with the action and the bigger pieces and all the trucks, so many trucks. And this one just lacked all that. And you know, not to say that there weren't some likable moments from it. Now, you mentioned one other scene. Like, what was some of the other bigger over-the-top moments?
Well, I want to piggyback off that first, which is I think the reason the two weird scenes are there, to your point, is because they didn't have a large budget. And the scenes are this. So this, in theory, follows more closely to the premise in that it's only trucks that are affected, asterisk. Because at a certain point, we cut to this random postal delivery, the postal carrier.
Oh, that's right.
And a remote-controlled dump truck is coming after him. And I think you even get like a POV of the truck at one point. Like it's very, this is the totally odd moment. And then the truck basically attacks him. The guy trips and falls, and it keeps ramming him in the head until he dies. And then that's it. It's so weird.
It was very, very weird and very kind of funny and kind of painful to watch. And wondering at some point, like, get up. What, how did you get down on the ground?
Yeah.
What, how did this happen? Now, I, it's funny that we mentioned this because in the Night Shift episode, Terry and I talked about a story in Night Shift called Battleground. And it is about a guy who essentially gets war waged on him in his apartment by these enchanted army toys.
Oh, that's right.
That were sent to him from this like creepy toy maker guy. And that was really believable. I almost kind of wonder, that kind of felt a little bit like, I don't want to go so far as to call it an homage, but it felt like maybe the person who made this read some Stephen King story, maybe knew that. Cause I like, maybe we can make it believable like that story was. I don't know, because it didn't quite translate, which is interesting when you consider that the screen adaptation of Battleground starring William Hurt was brilliant. Absolutely stunning piece of work on the Nightmares and Dreamscapes anthology show. They made that believable in the sense that this tiny little toy could take down a grown man and really threaten in him. So, but in this, it just didn't quite land the same way. But thank you for bringing that up, because I had forgotten about that until you brought that up. I was going through all the broad strokes and then I'm like, oh my God, yeah, the postal carrier. And it was like the one kind of, again, not a consistently applied rule set.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It felt like they needed to expand the story outside of this little gas station diner, but didn't have a huge budget to do it. And the other one is really bizarre. So we didn't mention there is a tanker truck that crashes into some electrical equipment, like whether it's like a small substation or something like that, or a little relay station. So it hits that and there's this huge plume of smoke. And this hazmat team has to come. It's two guys in this like bread truck kind of thing that are driving up there to deal with the chemical spill. And so one guy's in the truck and the other one gets into this like very cheap looking hazmat suit and goes out there. While he's doing that, the other hazmat suit inflates.
Oh.
And picks up an axe.
And just murders
and
this guy.
Chops the driver to death. And then the other guy comes to the back of the truck and thinks it's his buddy and it chops him up. And then the truck just starts driving, and that's about it. So an inflatable suit is being controlled by a machine, but it's moving like a human, like that.
Yeah, I agree.
And that was another just like odd choice in a movie that tried to stay with some internal logic and then was just like, you know what, screw it. And it felt almost more egregious than King and his adaptation, I think purely because he had already gone full schlock. So you're just like, yeah, of course, whatever.
And ultimately, a lot of these choices that this movie made feel in some ways like it encapsulates the 90s altogether. And I've mentioned this before. I often feel like the 90s feel like a decade that didn't really know itself, or it was like grasping for something like, am I going to calm down and chill? Or are we going to be like cool and different? And, you know, because the 80s were just like very high energy and a lot of out there kind of stuff.
Right.
And then the 90s just kind of like slicked down and minimalized and whatever. And it just wanted to be that. But then there's these moments and it's like, what are you going to be? What are you? And I feel like if they had done more of that, it would have been more a unique and memorable film than these scenes that feel like they were cut in from a different movie. And with characters that overall just, with the exception of the hippie guy, I just weren't terribly charismatic or interesting in any way.
You know, King gets some flack for not doing a lot of character development with Maximum Overdrive, but this movie, I felt everyone was much more just flat. Like, there's even a newlywed couple, but they're really ridiculous, and you kind of want them to die.
Like, she's just this gold-digging, you know, snooty as hell. And the husband's just like rolling his eyes and doing the yes dear routine. And it's just like, okay, both of you can go.
The only character that you really feel that way about in Maximum Overdrive is the Bible salesman, right? But he's a creep.
Yeah.
So you're like, creeps should get their comeuppance.
Right.
But these
right.
were just obnoxious people. Anyway, so I think character wise, there wasn't really anyone terribly interesting. Even Hope, the woman who runs the tour thing, she was just very not charismatic, very just kind of two-dimensional. And yeah, it's I think the only thing that kind of redeems this movie is how it ends.
Yes. And because Chris and I were talking about this before, so because we don't think we've talked a lot about this movie in terms of spoilers, but if you really do want to go see it, it's on YouTube, totally free.
Yep.
So go ahead and queue it up. It's just it's an hour and a half long or so. But we're going to just advise that if you don't want to hear how this movie ends, just skip forward a couple minutes because, that way we won't spoil that because, you know, we should at least think you should get something redeeming out of this and it would be the ending. So the helicopter. Now, set that stage a little more for me because I was actually crocheting when I made this.
Yeah, for sure.
When I watched this movie. So where did the helicopter actually come from?
Yeah, so now we're in spoiler territory. So they're making their escape plans and the military dad used to be in the Air Force or is, and he's familiar with Area 51 because he's kind of like poo-pooing the whole idea that there's aliens there or whatever. Because again, people are making all of these speculations as to what's going on. It's Area 51. It's the comet. It's this chemical explosion, all that kind of stuff. Well, he disappears with his daughter and I think on a motorcycle. That's right.
Yeah.
Ray's son, Logan, is like rebuilding this motorcycle, rebuilding it. So they escape and he's like, I'm going to bring a helicopter to rescue us all. And so the rest of our little ragtag team is running to catch this helicopter and they're trying to go where the trucks can't. But one of the trucks, the semi trucks, is chasing them down. And you see the helicopter swoop down low so they can all climb in. And it's one of these like action scenes again, in its own little low-budge way, where they hop on a helicopter and it pulls up just as this truck hits a conveniently placed ramp.
yeah, exactly.
But of course misses and just kind of crashes into this like mud pit or whatever. And yay, they're saved. Everyone's hugging and rejoicing. The daughter is back at the helicopter, but she looks really weird. She doesn't look happy and she looks almost catatonic, like she can't move with fear or something. And Timothy Busfield's character, Ray, leans up to talk to the dad who's piloting it, and he pulls the curtain back and there's nobody flying the helicopter. The helicopter talks to them, and I think it says something like, "Don't worry, guys. Sit back and relax. Everything's going to be okay." Something like that. And then they just fly away.
Yeah, and that is a chilling, fantastic ending.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I love an ambiguous ending, and this one I thought delivered in a great way.
Of course, because it's almost the ending I wish we'd had in Maximum Overdrive, which is ironic because, you know, King is always a big fan of his ambiguous endings, and he had an opportunity to deliver one and chose not to, unless he tried and the studio didn't let him. But this is a very good King ending in the spirit of Stephen King, because forever we'll just be wondering where these people ended up and, you know, what became of them. So if you're back after skipping ahead, by the way, the ending of this film is the reason I think that's worth spending a little bit of your, you know, like a boring Sunday afternoon. Just check it out. You know,
it's not an awful movie. It's not terrible. I'll say that much. It was better than I expected it to be. But you can't go in expecting another big budget, big explosion, lots of trucks, kind of a setting.
It's a great vehicle, so to speak, to deliver more appreciation for the movie Stephen King made.
Yeah.
I feel
I do.
Like I can absolutely look back after watching the USA version of Trucks and then watching Maximum Overdrive, I felt like I was getting the goods delivered, you know, from Maximum Overdrive in a way that I think a lot of people don't appreciate. I mean, people will just say, oh, it's cringy, it's whatever. But no, I'm not into cringe. I don't like that word. I don't, especially the way it's used these days. It's usually used to discredit things that evoke fun or feeling of some kind. To me, I feel like you need to lean into these things and enjoy them for what they are.
Yeah.
And Stephen King, if even his most pulpy, schlocky works, what, you know, written, screenplay, otherwise, I don't think I've ever really encountered one that I truly regretted experiencing. Even like his book, one of his books that's probably panned the most is Dreamcatcher. It's a very gross alien story, I'll just say. Mm. And it was adapted into a film with Morgan Freeman, and I can't remember who else was in it, but I think it was Thomas Jane, if I'm not mistaken. It's funny how some of these same actors just pop up in a Stephen King movie, but it's a fantastic read. It's so over the top fun and gross and just like engrossing at the same time. You want to find out how it goes because he makes you want to keep following along until the end. Mm. And for me, that's what Maximum Overdrive did. And, you know, I feel like this piece of pop culture is important to experience. So go and watch it. I order you people to watch it. Now, it is on the Roku channel. That's how we watched it.
Which one?
I think the Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to get an answer to the question, who made who? Who made you? Plus, just watch it for the sound effect and the explosions and the AC/DC soundtrack.
Up until like the sexy scene, you know, if you just watch it up until that point, you will be supremely rewarded.
I don't know. Skip ahead to the end when they make the escape and there's like more explosions and things.
Yeah, that's true. Because there are some good explosions to stay and enjoy. I hope that Joe Hill gets the opportunity to remake this film.
I think it'd be fun.
I think this is a prime remake property here. Mm-hmm. And I feel like enough people, if we get them, the newer kids experiencing Maximum Overdrive, and they will probably like to watch another fun take. Don't CGI it up. Don't Michael Bay it. It doesn't need that. Let's just have some smash and grab with some more slightly relatable characters and a little more horror. Make it a little more chilling. and maybe a little less camp. And then I feel like that would be, that would strike a good balance. And it shouldn't, but it still shouldn't take itself too seriously. That's, I feel like if you go a little too seriously with a concept like this, it, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I'm kind of thinking out loud here, Chris.
I mean, the short story takes it, it doesn't take itself seriously, but the short story approaches it from a very visceral, real,
it's very bleak.
Bleak kind of standpoint. So I think it's doable, certainly.
And it doesn't need to be a TV series. Just make a movie.
Just make a movie.
It only needs to be a couple hours long.
Yeah, you don't need anything more.
You can just enjoy it and go about your day. You don't have to involve yourself in a 7-episode miniseries. Just go watch a damn movie, you know? They still have a purpose out there. So,
that's right.
So do you have anything you want to add on Maximum Overdrive trucks or trucks?
I don't. I just think this was a fun way to end season 2 of the podcast. We were going to make this an extra episode, like a bonus. And then we're like, wait, there's a short story, a movie, and a movie to talk about? And you're like, yeah, let's just make this the big blowout finale. And I was thinking, that is perfect. It's just a bombastic way to go out. I love it.
And a great way to showcase King working in all of the possible things. I mean, I think we would be remiss not to talk about the one and only directorial outing that he had. So yeah, a great way to end it. And we do have some other tiny little things up our sleeves for bonuses and stuff.
Or not so tiny.
But yeah, possibly. We'll see. Well, that's true. Actually, yeah, we're not going to reveal that here. You just have to wait for the surprises.
That's right.
But as the show continues to grow, so are my aspirations to just make it bigger and better. And that's not possible without my friends and especially you, the listeners. So if you can, please get the word out. Dropping a review on iTunes is still the best way to help the show. But even if you post about it on social media or tell your friends, rate it on Spotify, that would be great. And feel free to reach out to me directly on Twitter, Gmail, and Instagram at @DDDarknessTime. That's all the handles there. Also, take the time to hop over to 80s High and enjoy the true expertise that Ben and Chris bring to the party regarding that decade.
That's right. We're on summer break if you're listening to this during the summertime, but you can catch up on seasons 1 and 2 of our podcast as well. And then just re-listen to this one because it's so much fun. You've got 2 seasons. And if you don't want to hear my voice, there's a couple episodes I'm not on, so you get a little reprieve. It's great.
Only Chris doesn't like hearing his own voice.
Who does? No one likes listening to their own voice. Well,
that's true. I've inured myself to my own voice as I edit these shows.
You know, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, you just go numb inside until it's over.
You're just like, really? That's what I sound like? Okay, we're going to go on. All right.
Which is funny because here I am, you know, trying to do more content.
That's right.
You know, because I have the Ding Dong Ditch episodes coming up where it's just me.
That's right.
So I get to listen to just me talking. But we have exciting plans for season 3 coming in the fall. So there will be more word out, more expansions happening, more of everything.
That's right.
Because we can't have enough.
The best thing you can do for season 3 is to follow this podcast.
Oh, yes. Join us. Follow us.
Become one of us.
All right, guys. Well, thank you again for sticking around for season 2. And be on the lookout for bonus episodes and Ding Dong Ditch. And then season 3. Good things happening.
Later, Ding Dongs.
Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding-dongs.